on the Pilot TV podcast this week, we immerse ourselves in Dominic Savage's thought-provoking I Am anthology series, explore the seedier side of superheroes in Amazon's edgy new comic-inspired series, The Boys, and prepare to say goodbye to Litchfield Penitentiary once and for all in the seventh and final season of Orange is the New Black. I'm James Dyer, and welcome to the Pilot TV podcast, a show that can only apologise for the full start we gave you last week when we got you all hot and bothered under the impression that Terry was going to give you her appraisal of Downton Abbey, only to throw a cold bucket of disappointment over the whole thing. However, this week I am reliably informed that there will be no such anticlimax. For joining me today as we come out of the weekend, whatever one of those might be, is our very own Dowager Countess, the true lady of Pilot Abbey and mistress of our orderly household. It's Lady Teresa White.
We all know that I'm Daisy. That's my biggest takeaway from Downton Abbey. I am Daisy.
It's true.
Spoiler alert, you've watched it.
I have watched
it. Wait, steady. Don't jump the gun. You've heard him, but joining us on this auspicious occasion is our very own Mrs. Patmore. He runs the Pilot kitchens like a well-oiled machine, makes a mean apple crumble, and will clip you round the ear if he catches you not stirring the custard properly. It's Mr. Boyd Hilton.
Apple crumble is one of the few desserts I can make.
Really?
Yeah.
How do you make
it?
What's the secret?
You just stew the apples, make sure you've got enough sugar, otherwise they'll be a bit sour. Make sure they're soft enough. And crumble's fairly easy. You get some oats and some...
biscuit, surely, isn't it? All
biscuit stuff, yeah, and butter, lots of butter, and it's fine.
What is happening? What the fuck?
Sorry.
This has become fucking, like, Great British Boyd Bake Off.
It has. Yeah. See, gradually, Boyd, I don't know if you've realised this, but steadily, slowly, I am becoming you and I'm usurping you. And this came to the fore yesterday when... Dermot O'Leary started following me on Twitter.
Out of the blue,
out of nowhere, because he just thought, you know what? You know, if I'm going to have a bald friend, I think maybe I'll upgrade. I think maybe I'll pick this one instead.
Well, you are taller.
That's true. There's taller. More of me. I'm better value in that regard.
Absolutely. 100%. Oh, fair enough. As long as he doesn't unfollow me.
And, you know, James Corden, albeit reluctantly, still follows me. So there's
that. Hanging out with Russell Tovey?
No. Does Russell follow me? I don't think he does. Okay, I'll see what I can do about that.
Fine. I give it 6 days, Max, before Dermot unfollows him. Who is this insufferable, smug... No, I'm not going to say the B word. Not going to say the B word or the C word.
I thought you said the C word.
Yeah. The smug James.
Yes. Who is this smug James that I accidentally followed thinking he was Boyd Hilton? So that's
Can I just say something about Russell Tovey quick? He's doing Latitude. So as we speak, we're a Friday. Latitude starts tomorrow. He is doing his art podcast there, right, where he gets people to talk about their art, what they love about art. And guess who? His guest is incredible.
Lena Dunham. I just saw this.
Fucking Lena Dunham.
That's pretty good.
How does that happen?
Yeah, we don't have Lena Dunham.
He just asked her. And she went, yeah, all right. So I hope she shows up, because we're doing this in advance. She'll show up, it'll be fine. But that is a brilliant guest, isn't it?
Pretty good. That's pretty good.
I had a dream about Russell Tovey. Well, I had a dream about Boyd. Oh, yeah. So I had a dream about Boyd that we were on an EasyJet business class flight to New York, where Boydie and I were going for work. You were nowhere to be seen.
Doesn't surprise me.
I imagine you were either plane-splaining to the pilot or down the back of the plane trying to get people to watch Fire Escape. And basically, they lost our business class bookings and I was going mental.
Well, that's why they couldn't find me, because I was clearly in economy and you two were in business.
Well, no, so they'd lost it. So they said, you're going to have to sit in economy. And Boyd tried to kind of impress them by going, hang on. I'm friends with Russell Tovey. Does that get us an upgrade? And they said, no.
Wow. See, your celebrity friends avail you nothing, Boyd.
Yeah. I did actually once fly to New York with Caroline Ahern. How about this? Years ago.
Please tell me that's not the end of the story.
No, and this was mid success of the royal family and everything. She was an incredibly famous person, and we were flying together on this flight, and they wouldn't upgrade us. I was furious. I was like,
"Hang on,
I'm fucking her."
But if you're Caroline Ahern, or presumably her publicist would have.
She didn't really have like publicists and stuff. She kept it real. So it was like, she didn't really want to pay for a first class flight. We thought, well, we might get upgraded. I was thinking it'd be fine. You're going to get upgraded. And we just weren't.
Well, she strikes me as somebody who wouldn't have given a fuck about being upgraded.
No, she didn't.
Boyd was furious.
Boyd was the one.
I was totally like, I'm getting a fucking first class fight, and I didn't. That's my name drop for this segment of the podcast.
Okay, okay. We'll have many more of those look forward to later on. But let's get straight into what we're watching. And let's start with Terry, who watched Downton Abbey. Now, did you watch the entire feature-length pilot?
Yes.
Okay, good. So you made it all the way through.
Yes.
Were you tempted to watch a bit more?
Yes. No. So I have some thoughts. Daisy, spirit animal.
Yes.
Bates, breaks my heart.
Oh,
Thomas, what a dick. Carson, would very much like him to be my dad, but not my real dad because he abandoned me. So like a fake dad who didn't do that.
Yep.
Mary, what a bitch. Anna, would very much like to be her when I grow up. Mrs. O'Brien, what a bitch.
Yeah.
Those are my thoughts on Downton Abbey. And I may have enjoyed it immensely.
How much? See, Cousin Matthew's not in it that much, is he?
No.
Yeah, because obviously he becomes a big part of it.
But it's what's weird is trying to establish who everybody is, who's going to be like the big, important, significant characters and what the significant arcs are going to be. And that's quite exciting. Mm. That's why I love like the first episodes of anything, because you just don't know what's ahead. It's the TV, when you watch the first episode of something you grow to really love, right? That is the moment of ultimate hope and optimism, don't you think, where anything is possible narratively from a character perspective. So I'm taking it easy this weekend, and I may be planning to watch the first season of Downton Abbey.
Oh,
fuck you, James.
A full Downton Abbess.
Fuck you.
This is amazing.
Oh, God. It's like Shakespeare, really. It's Shakespearean.
Have you cracked what the appeal is? Do you?
I mean, well, but it is Shakespeare. Right. It's Shakespearean. Fundamentally, it's about all the things that make human relationships interesting. It's about power. It's about betrayal. It's about love. It's about. But when you're within a traditional social structure and power structure within that, a hierarchy that society has laid upon you, then you get kind of interesting arcs within that. So, you know, the kind of duplicity and evil that goes on below stairs and how that contrasts with what goes on above stairs. But fundamentally, it is about the human dynamics that make us, you know, human beings still today.
You have not mentioned Maggie Smith.
I mean, she's, of course, but old cantankerous bitch.
But magnificently so. And purveyor of the best lines in the entire show.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, the way she wears that hat alone is extraordinary.
Yeah.
I love it. I love it. When I was very young, I used to watch House of Elliot with my nana. And it was one of my favourite things ever. And I know it's obviously a completely different period because that was 1920s. But this really reminded me of like the first time I watched House of Elliot and just fell completely into that period thing. And you give away all of your like cynicism and all of your horrible judgments. And you just kind of sink into the marshmallow loveliness.
Because a lot happens in the pilot. And I'd kind of forgotten this because you've got the kind of subplot with Thomas and the visiting lord.
And the Duke.
And the letters and like that they have a thing and he gets essentially cast aside
that,
and that's all very fraught.
That moment when you realise what's really going on is incredible.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, it's going to have some of this in it as well.
And then Lady Mary, the scandal.
Oh my God. I hate her already. I hate her. And her poor sister, when she's like,
poor Lady Edith.
Oh, he skipped the bait. And she went, at least I have, I'm, no, he, oh, hang on, I've got it. Oh, he slipped the hook. And she went, at least I have bait to be fishing with. Don't be horrible to your, yes, uglier sister, but you know, she's got gifts.
Poor Edith gets shit all the way through this show.
Oh,
poor,
God.
Poor Lady Edith.
Is Matthew Crawley in the first episode?
He is. But he's still being quite frosty and doesn't like them very much. Like, right, he doesn't like the family,
but
he doesn't like the daughters.
There's only the scene at the end with him.
Right.
Is that the only scene?
I'm trying to remember whether they bring him right at the end. Yeah,
right at the end. He goes, oh. He opens the telegram and goes, oh. Oh, he's planning to change your lives, Mama. And she goes, oh, how extraordinary.
Oh, is that
Penelope
it?
Wilton.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I didn't realise, because it's like his first meeting with Mary is particularly fun.
Yeah.
So that turns into...
You have to say, because what's his name, the creator? You know, the Tory.
Julian Fellowes.
He is brilliant. at what you're saying, these first episodes, where he can establish 20 characters in about half an hour, and you kind of do know them pretty well. It is incredible.
And it's these two stratas, these two ecosystems, the upstairs and the downstairs, and the hierarchy within the downstairs is fascinating. Yeah. The fact that, you know, there's the difference between, like, who's to be a footman, and what's the difference between a footman and then a valet. Yeah, there's a big difference there. And obviously there's a certain tier where they use their first names, and then they use their surnames when they're more senior.
Yeah.
And, you know, Mr. Carson is, for all intents and purposes, the Lord below the stairs. And it's...
But there are also real... I loved the kind of real moments they dropped in, which they're clearly, I hope, going to pick up on. So when... What's her name? The woman who runs the whole house.
What, Mrs. Hughes?
Yes. And she says, to Carson, oh, do you ever wish you'd gone a different way, worked in a shop or in a factory, had a wife, had children? This incredible moment of vulnerability and longing, and clearly something that she'd never said out loud before. And he was like, oh, do you? And then that was gone and over, and they were back to formality. And the moment where the other footman was feeling homesick, and he said how he loved being busy because then he didn't have time to think. And these little snatches into, as Boyd says, when you've got that many characters, to be able to have those little emotional beats as well as just doing the kind of fundamental positioning of who and what they are is amazing.
Well, you wait until you get to the bit where you discover that Mr. Carson used to be part of a travelling circus.
Oh my God.
There's so much to come.
Oh my God. And what is family and what defines family?
There's a lot of class abrasion where, like, that cross the divide, forbidden romances. There's lots of that going on.
Let me tell you, Daisy, I'm obsessed with her. When they were going out to greet the Duke, and she was like, oh, me and all. He was like, no, not you, Daisy. And she was like, I swear to God, I saw my own face in her face at one point.
Yeah, you are very much Daisy. I love it. Like the Christmas episodes, Christmas in the Highlands, all of those. There's so much love. Weirdly, I do think, it does go off the boil. I do think it goes. I'm really looking forward to the movie, which now you're looking forward to as well, much against your better judgment, because you were like, I can't wait to see it. And you're like, oh, fucking hell. And now you're going to be like, oh, but you can't watch it now because it'd be a massive spoiler. You've got to work through all of the episodes.
How many seasons?
You've got 52 episodes.
How many seasons are there?
Six series. Six seasons. 52 episodes.
But bear in mind, there's a Christmas special each year, which you have to watch.
There's two episodes a year that are feature length. Yeah. The first episode's feature length, and the Christmas
special. And the Christmas special. You have to watch the Christmas
special. Boy.
It's a lot. Lots of stuff happens. Illicit pregnancies. Oh, there's so much stuff.
I'm jealous. I've watched every single fucking episode.
Yeah, so have I. Loved it.
I used to do quite a few of them. I used to do like big interviews with him on Apple. I used to do those.
Oh, really? Yeah. The last season, I thought, wasn't, you know, that was the weakest one. Like, I kind of coasted through.
I think he'd run out because he was doing lots of other things. Had he on the, he's still got other things. Mm. He did that Titanic thing, which failed. He did a big Titanic drama on ITV Sunday Night, which is going to be his next big thing. And he did the same thing in the first episode, was basically upstairs and downstairs on the Titanic, 32 characters introduced in an hour and a half, but it didn't quite work. Yeah. And people,
Also, isn't it hard to invest in people when you know they're going to die?
Right. That could have something to do with
it. That seems entirely fair, I think.
Someone I assume you'd realise.
We'd really like you to invest in these people for the next 7 days until they meet their watery grave.
Weekly Downton updates from now on.
Yes.
Excellent. Boyd, what have you been watching?
What have I been watching? I got up this morning to have a look at my Netflix, and I was going to watch the robbery drama that I mentioned last week, the Spanish robbery drama. But instead, I found myself watching Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee with Jerry Seinfeld, because there's 12 new episodes of that, and it's one of my favourite things. The first episode is with Eddie Murphy, and is most of the episodes are like 15 to 20 minutes long, and they're brilliant anyway. It's just him, if you've never seen it, driving along in some swanky car with a famous comedian guest, and they're going to get coffee and they chat shit. But the Eddie Murphy one is like 40, 45 minutes long, so it's a proper kind of juicy chat with him about all kinds of stuff.
Oh, I'd love to watch that. I'm obsessed with Eddie Murphy.
Fantastic, honestly. And then other people in it, you've got Ricky Gervais is in it across two episodes. And it's just fantastic. So yeah, I'll be watching that.
No, I'm definitely going to watch it, because he doesn't do any press, Eddie Murphy doesn't, not much anyway.
No.
And I love him. I absolutely love
Seth
him.
Seth Rogen's also, I'm just forgetting that now, the people are in it. Seth Rogen, Matthew Broderick, Jamie Foxx. Now, you may notice in a minute, Martin Short, who's one of my heroes, there aren't that many women. In fact, let me just count. There are two women, Bridget Everett and Melissa Villaseñor, which is, out of 12, is not great. But apart from that, it's a brilliant show.
I'm only going to watch the Eddie Murphy one anyway, so.
Okay. Oh, all right.
Yeah.
Did we discuss, you know, we talked about Big Little Lies last week.
We did.
But I think the big,
we're going to get on to that. I mean, I am up to date on Big Little Lies and after.
It's the same, yeah.
You know, the thing before the thing last week?
Yeah.
Like, so I was interested that the thing obviously got addressed, but the thing before the thing didn't get addressed much. Like, that was, I'm going to like more from the thing before the thing. Now, the thing at the end, again, that did get addressed.
Yeah.
But again, I wasn't entirely satisfied with how that got.
Yeah, quite quickly.
But then more stuff happened, and the way this one ends was like, oh.
I mean, I right now, I can't wait for the finale on Monday.
The thing after the thing after the thing was.
But we'll talk about the issue.
Was a thing.
Are we talking about the issue in news? Is that
talk about the issue in news.
Right.
What have I been watching? I picked up Killing Eve season 2 again because it occurred
Killing
to me.
Eve?
Killing Heave.
Killing Heave.
Killing Heave. I've gone full upstairs. Killing Heave. Yeah, so I went back to Killing Eve. It occurred to me I only watched the first two episodes of season 2 before moving on to other things, which was silly of me. So I've gone back to that and I'm really enjoying it. So I'm storming through Killing Eve. I also started watching the last season of Jessica Jones.
Oh.
Why?
A rewatch.
I don't know what. I think for some reason, at the moment I started watching it, I only had access to Netflix. And I saw it there and went, yeah, all right. And I started watching it. So I've seen, I think, the first three. And I'm quite pleased with it. It's not super exciting at this stage, but I think it's still getting going. But, you know, some quite shocking things happen. There's a stabbing, which kind of comes out of nowhere. It's quite Trish heavy, which is, I have no idea what that means. Not a great thing. Like, I don't find Trish to be the most compelling character.
Mm.
So that's unfortunate. Also, there's a point where Kristen Ritter does do kind of like stink face all the time. Do you know what I mean? Like, she has that like eye-rolly sort of like, ugh, face. Like, she has stink face all the time. And it gets to the point where you're just like...
Stink face?
I'm calling it stink face.
Is that your own phrase?
Yes, I'm calling it stink face. It's that kind of like... It's almost like, you know, it's bad smell face. Like, she has it.
Yeah,
just stop grimacing.
Pull another expression.
Yeah, another expression. Just a different expression. Okay. Even if that expression is also of disdain, maybe just, you know, a little less stink face. Mm. But anyway, I'm going to watch the rest of this. I don't know at what speed, but I plan to make it through to the end of Jessica Jones.
Yeah,
I should emphasise that is not my way of saying smile love to Kristen Ritter.
That is absolutely not what I'm saying.
Know,
I held my breath at that point.
Yeah,
it's not like
I will say,
is fine, just different shades of disdain.
I will say is men very rarely get accused of that thing in the same way. Nobody goes, oh, did you see The Rock had that same face his entire film?
Because Kristen Stewart gets it a lot as well, doesn't she? But then she does have perma stink face too.
Here's the thing. So do loads of fucking men. It's just women are expected to
have slightly
more...
You're probably right. You know. Well, there's got to be one. Let's think of one now.
Go on.
I'm wondering, that's what I'm saying. Help me.
With the
male stink face, because there's bound to be some. Let's find some. I know it's quite hard to do this on the spot. Boyd, help us out.
So we're thinking of a man who has the same, not just the same expression, but that expression.
No, just a similar sort of like, you know.
So... Edward in Twilight, i.e. Robert Pattinson, his face is the entire way through.
He does.
Yeah, that's true.
Like, he doesn't,
it's
his
not
face
quite
doesn't move.
Stink face, but it's similar to.
It is.
He has perpetual fucking bewildered face.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
And that's not good either.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I think it's just, it's variants of expression. But yes, no, we definitely don't hold to the that awful trope that, maybe he should just smile
Nobody
more.
Expects Robert Pattinson to smile.
No, but we expect him to look less bewildered.
Yes.
Yeah.
We'd like him to.
Looking forward to Batman. Anyway, that takes us now to Funny or Die, our regular segment in which we revisit a classic episode of comedy chosen by you. The subject of this week's experiment was chosen by Jake French and is Scrubs Season 6, Episode 6, My Musical, which, I've got to be honest, is an odd choice. Because I think, like, as a musical episode, I think this is actually clever and well executed, but I would say this is not as funny as this show can get by a long stretch, because I've seen a number of Scrubs in the past, and it can be really funny. This is just, it's an interesting device. So the idea in this particular one is a patient comes in with a brain aneurysm, and one of the side effects of her brain aneurysm is that everyone around her appears to be in musical theatre.
Well, let's just clarify, because when she's not brought in with an aneurysm, she's brought in and they think she's mad.
Yeah, they
because,
do. So,
you know,
but it turns out,
and then
spoiler,
it turns out
she has an aneurysm.
To be an aneurysm. And there's an incredible, like, you know, she must be mental.
Yeah, she must be nuts. She must be nuts. That's the whole thing. So, it's an interesting device in that, so they only sing. You are scrubsplaining. she only sings when, or rather the cast only sings when she's present. Yes. So when she's out the room, they speak normally, and as soon as she enters the room, they burst into song. And I think the songs are very, very musical theatre to the point where they almost feel like riffs on existing...
There's a whole Grease. We go together like...
And there's a Les Mis bit in there as well. So, and I watch this, but it's very, very hard, I think, these days to look at a musical episode and not see it through the prism of Once More With Feeling, which is the high watermark for musical episodes. And I think what Joss Whedon did with that episode of Buffy was not only create an incredible musical episode with amazing, memorable, brilliant musical numbers, but the amount of emotional and narrative ground covered in that episode is almost more than any other episode of that fucking show. And yet he does it through the medium of song.
And that was the device, right? Is the things that were unspoken or unsaid or were their deepest fears, desires, needs... It was such a simple device, but it was so fucking effective, because actually it's the juxtaposition of the musical, which seems frothy and without substance, and actually the fact that, as you say, it's doing this incredible amount of emotional storytelling, that it's fucking genius.
And this all...
This is not that.
No, and this is all despite the fact that Alison Hannigan couldn't sing and therefore basically doesn't participate in the episode. But no, we're not talking
about
that.
Whereas there are a lot of people who can't sing in this episode who do participate.
Yeah.
I think this is different, isn't it? This is just, like, I feel like this is in the middle of a big run of a big hit show, and they're thinking of what ideas can we have, and of course they thought, right, let's do a musical episode, and they've found quite a good plot device to enable
they do it well.
But I agree with you, the problem with it is I think the reason it was chosen is because it is memorable. You know, you go, oh yeah, that was that musical episode they did, but actually it's one of, in my opinion, the least effective episodes, because it's kind of all the strong points of the show, which are the characters, are lessened due to the fact they've all got to sing these fucking songs. And John C. McGinley, who I think is the best thing in it, generally, is like, his power is completely reduced because he's got to sing these songs. Yeah. And he's really harsh and horrible all the way through Scrubs to Zach Braff. But that just doesn't come across well enough in this episode.
Although I like the bit when the patient steps in front of him and calls J.D. Mary Beth in song to try and get on. I thought that was quite a nice moment.
Moments, and that, you know, I kind of admired it because the songs are clever and the lyrics are very smart, and as you say, they're pastiches, but I might, and it's just not funny.
It's not funny at any point.
I'm not a massive fan of Scrubs, but there have definitely been, you know, it's one of those things that had come on, you wouldn't be asked to turn it off. You might have a half laugh inside the very depths of your soul, which if you really forced it could come out of your mouth into an actual real world physical laugh. But this is one of the unfunniest things I've seen.
I mean, what Terry's saying is it's no Downton Abbey. I will say that this is not the worst musical episode ever. I think that particular award possibly goes to Grey's Anatomy. Do you remember the musical episode of Grey's Anatomy?
No.
I didn't see it. I was aware of it.
Fucking hell.
No, they didn't actually do that.
I think it's one of the characters is in a coma or a car accident or something, and it's all musical, and it's just make it stop. So
it's funny because the question, would you do a musical episode, is asked, I think, of pretty much every long-running show. And I remember once being a Doctor Who screening, and Stephen Moffat was asked, would you do a musical episode of Doctor Who? And he was like, fuck no.
Oh, a musical episode of This Is England is something that I think is still holding on for.
Oh my God, James.
Be more chanting, really, wouldn't it, than singing? But still, I'm on board with
PJ Harvey. I mean, you know, she could do the songs. Yeah,
I mean, it wouldn't be the most upbeat musical.
No, probably not.
Not many song and dance numbers, maybe.
Sorry, Jay. You dropped the ball on that one, I'm afraid. I think Scrubs was a good choice. It's a good instinct there. Bad choice of episode. So did that make me laugh? No. Did it make any of us laugh? No. So next week, let's hope for the best. Next week's subject comes from a number of people, actually, and is Peep Show, Series 2, Episode 4, University Challenge. Which I believe, according to the internet, is often held as the ultimate episode of Peep Show.
I mean, I love Peep Show, so yeah. Fine.
The Wedding was another one that was kicked around.
Oh yeah, The Wedding. I don't remember what you knew.
But University Challenge is the one that I picked. I don't know anything, but I've never seen an episode of Peep Show ever.
I mean, that's very good.
Something I admitted to Sam Bain on the other podcast.
Great.
So I'm looking forward to this, and I'm hoping that I like it. I do not know where this will fall on my humorometer.
No,
so, I mean, it's intriguing. If you want to rewatch that one before next week, then fill your boots, and we'll, you know, find out then. Right, there's a lot to get through in news, so I suggest, before we get on to the Emmys, let's get into the other thing first. So we've referenced it already. This is Big Little Lies, which, of course, was directed by Jean-Marc Vallée for season one. And he is replaced in season two by Andrea Arnold because he was busy doing Sharp Objects. Now, as it emerged over the last few days, IndieWire did a piece on this. Andrea Arnold was, shall we say, I believe, hired for her vision. I believe Jean-Marc Vallée thought he saw a kindred spirit in her and thought that she would be similar to him. But anyway, they said that they wanted her unique sensibility for this. They wanted it to be very much her show. And yet it has emerged that that maybe was not the case. And they have Vallée whitewashed her work and tried to turn it into his work. And this, Terry, by the expression on your face, is something that makes you want to set the world on fire.
It's made me so angry I can't watch.
Well, no, we've discussed this.
James is insistent. Yeah. Again, a man trying to control what a woman does. Yeah. But, you know, let's just leave that on the table for 1 minute. I found this story so upsetting. And we should just say that IndieWire reported this story out with several sources. It was a really long-form piece of original reporting.
It was.
HBO put out a statement which had no denial of the basic story, but they had a quote which said, "There would be no season two of Big Little Lies without Andrea Arnold." That was their statement. Mm. Which, if even part of what Big Little, if even part of what IndieWire has reported is true, is incredibly disingenuous. Mm. So, as you say, she was brought on board, led to believe she was given full creative control. Once she was done, the shoot was done, and she was editing in London with her own team, there were moves for him to set up his own edit. It was taken from her. Those episodes were all re-edited by him and his team, and then there were 17 days of reshoots, which have been described as she was there on set, as was he, and that it was very much under his close supervision is what it's being described as.
Did she have to be there for DGO rules, I think, is that right?
Yeah, but also, and there are sources in the story saying she is absolutely devastated at what happened because creative control was taken away from her, and that was not the deal. As you say, she was brought on for her vision. You know, anybody who's seen any of her films, whether it's Fish Tank, whether it's American Honey, whether it's Wuthering Heights, she has a sensibility, an aesthetic sensibility more than anything, and a way of telling stories that is really interesting and really unique. There's kind of some conversation about, you know, well, TV is much more about within a show having a certain overarching style, which maybe they were just trying to get her work to fit within that. There has clearly been an epic kind of, at the very best, there's been an epic fail in communication where a female director has been led to believe she has complete creative control, and that has been taken off her, not during the shoot, but afterwards when it comes to crafting it. People have commented that some of the episodes have seemed kind of weird or chaotic, or the editing, something seemed off for some people, which I think that's part of a retrospective thing, but also people were saying it at the time. I think it's fair to say that treating a female filmmaker, who, by the way, is telling stories originally written by a woman, and this is a show which is about platforming female narratives, for this to have been done to a female storyteller, I think is... it's not just a bad look, it's incredibly unprofessional, and I cannot imagine to be Andrea Arnold, the woman, she's Oscar nominated, right? To be Andrea Arnold and to have to endure that humiliation, which shouldn't be her humiliation because she didn't do anything wrong, but to have to endure that publicly now, I think must be so devastating.
Like, you can definitely try and push the narrative that TV should have an overarching style. And yes, and also I would go so far as to say on a lot of TV, directors are a little bit like director of the week, their jobby thing, and that's fine for TV as a whole. But if that's the case, then get a jobbing director to do it, and don't promise someone that you're hiring them for their style. Don't get a named director and then get some man to kind of direct splain over her work. Because I think, really, she was just missold a horrendous bill of goods with this. And that seems to be the biggest problem here. But as we said, you know, it makes you want to punish them. However, Terry, you're not allowed to punish us. So you still have to watch it because there are many things in there that I want to discuss with you.
Well, and here's the thing. It's not about punishing. And I think it's worth saying that, you know, Reese Witherspoon and Nicole Kidman are both producers on this. Neither have commented, by the way, so far. Mm. But there are many people who work on this whose hard work is now not completely erased because of what's happened, of course. And I just find it very hard to watch it when it's so fresh, when you know what has gone on in terms of the creation of it.
I mean, it's besmirched the whole thing for me. And it is devastating because, I mean, I've been loving it. And now I feel completely guilty for loving it as much as I have done.
Dirty.
And also for kind of not reason, because you're right, there has been a lot of retro, you know, people saying, oh, it's always... And you could see some people online saying it had got a bit messy in terms of the editing and but for me, fundamentally, it's still a brilliant show. Mm. It is still a brilliant show. And a lot of that, I'm sure, is down to both David E. Kelly's writing. I think officially he's the showrunner, right? So it's interestingly complicated. And then again, in that report, they said he wasn't on set that much and he did leave it to Andrew Arnold, which is quite rightly, you know.
Yeah.
He's written it, it's fine. They've brought in Andrew Arnold, as you say, this brilliant auteur, and let her do what she wants to do. And there were all those quotes from those stars and exec producers saying how excited they were and what a brilliant job she did.
Yeah.
All the way through of creating this show. So I didn't see any great fault in it, actually. Yeah. It's a different kind, slightly is different in a way. And there is a slight messiness to it, but I kind of like that. And there were some incredible sequences that I feel now I'm looking back going, oh, so that's very Andrew Arnoldy, this bit here. There's a bit, I'm not the first person to point out, there's a Guardian feature that pointed out there's a scene in the courtroom where she walks in, Nicole Kidman walks in in the previous episode that's very her and you know, it felt... Anyway, long story short, what baffles me about the whole thing is Jean-Marc Vallée, one of the reasons he didn't do season two is because he did the crime series that we loved on
Shop
HBO.
Objects,
thank you, Shop Objects. And did a brilliant job on that, right? They bring Andrew Arnold in to do what she does. Whatever she delivered, even if, say, in theory, Jean-Marc Vallée and the HBO people and everyone thought, oh, it's a bit kind of, you know, words like indulgent, maybe they thought it was a bit too slow, maybe they thought she hadn't quite had the same, didn't have quite the same narrative snappiness as season one. Fuck it, it's HBO. This is the place where you go to for bold storytelling and you go to it for this kind of thing. It's not NBC. It's not a mainstream American TV channel. They didn't have to do this. And that's what really bewilders me. It's like, as you say, it feels to me, and this is all supposition on my part, but it's like, for some reason, Jean-Marc Vallée and people felt they had to stamp their thing on it. But now everyone, I really love to see her version of it.
Yeah.
And it's not like those twats that want, you know, release the original version.
The Arnold cut, release the Snyder cut.
Some fucking DC superhero film. This is like, I want to see her creative vision of this brilliant story with these amazing characters, these brilliant actresses, and I feel I've been deprived of that.
Yeah.
So that now is my overarching thing, as opposed to just that it is a really good show still.
And what's more confusing is there was reporting in that story saying the difficulty was all the way through. So when they were getting the dailies, they were saying how great it was and everything during the shoot and everything they were seeing as she shot, they loved.
Yeah.
And let's be clear, she'd only just started the edit when it was taken away from her. So how do you know too flabby or too fat or too slow?
Yeah,
you haven't
like,
let her do her edit. Yeah. And it does, what you're saying makes more sense, which is it feels like more of a personal wrestle for control than it does somebody going, hang on, you need to parachute in and save something. Because you'd have realised way before, when they were getting the dailies at the start of the shoot, if it was that significant a problem, they would have said, this isn't really working out, and there'd have been a solution at that point.
And I was thinking about her films, actually, like, because I read another thing about saying how, this is a bit mainstream for her because her films are so, you know, arty. But actually, when you watch her films, even the 2.5-hour America thingy one, I forget the names.
American Honey.
Thank you, American Honey. Even that, a long film, it's very enjoyable while you're watching it. She's not a self-indulgent, I'm gonna have long, boring scenes for the sake of it. It's a very entertaining, you know, film. And all her films are like, they're very compelling. And I think that, so I just don't buy I think she's been cast as a kind of indulgent indie person.
Yeah, that's not
And
the
I don't
thing,
think
yeah.
that is right at all. Mm. She's a brilliant, brilliant director who makes very, very involving, unbelievably compelling films. I want to see her version of this.
I should clarify, like when I was speaking before about jobbing directors. I don't in any way want to diminish TV directors do. And I think that probably came across quite badly, which is not what I was meant to do.
You're right.
But you know what I mean? What I'm saying is that in terms of the directorial vision, in film, it is much more of about the director style, sure, about the director. Whereas in TV, there is an expectation that a director fits into the style of the show, with the exception of things like True Detective, or as you say, when they have a directorial vision.
Many, many TV shows, including ones on HBO and Netflix and everything, have one or two or three or four directors for an eight-part series.
Yes.
The whole thing about this show is they got one director, Andrew Arnold, and when they make
and
everyone's like punching in the air, like, that makes sense. Because even though her style is different to Jean-Marc Vallée, and it's like, yeah, that's going to work, because there are certain similarities, there are differences, and everyone's like, yeah, this is going to be brilliant to see her version of this thing, and that's what we've been denied, and she's been denied, more importantly.
Indeed. Indeed.
Terrible.
Andrew Arnold released a statement. It was, of course, rewritten by Jean-Marc Vallée. Kidding! That's not true. Lawyers, I just made that up. Sorry, guys. Sorry, guys.
I think we're at the point where I don't think they're going to hit upon your joke. I think
they've got bigger fish to fry. Problems. Okay,
but it's interesting that nothing's been denied about that whole story.
No.
By anyone
involved. She hasn't commented at all.
No. And fair play to her for being super classy as well. I think that's, but also...
I don't even know if it's been super classy, because she should be able to talk about what happened to her, because actually there's something really valuable for our industry to learn about the way that female filmmakers in particular are treated. Mm. But also, I just think, while everybody's being supportive, I would personally find this a really humiliating situation to have the finer details of probably the most difficult working relationship of your life broadcast for everybody to read, and to know that creative control has been taken away from you, and have people commenting on why that might be and why maybe you're not a good enough director. Like, I cannot think of anything more difficult and humiliating for any filmmaker to have to go through. So quite frankly, if she wanted to like speak about it for 2 days, then she should do that. If she just wants to shut the fuck up and not have to explain herself or talk about this anymore to anybody, then she's perfectly within her rights to do all of it.
Yeah. Okay, well, there's lots of other news. We best move on. Let's get to the Emmys last. So let's just gallop through the other bits and bobs first. Oh, okay. There are a few little bits. There's a new picture from Picard, but I'm not going to talk about it because I'm going to spare you this week. Except, you know.
How can there be another one? There was only one last week.
It's him and the dog standing in the fucking vineyard again. At this point, Eva, I'm like, can I see her? Can I see a spaceship? No, he's facing the other way this time. I'm a bit like, come on. Like, it would kill you to have a phaser or a Klingon. Anyway, let's move on. Along those lines, though, Terry, there's a Warhammer 40,000 TV series in development.
I don't know what those words mean.
Well, allow me to explain in excruciating detail. So, the Man in the High Castle creator and former X-Files writer Frank Spotnitz is working to move Games Workshop's Warhammer 40,000 desktop strategy game, which is the little, you know, the little lead figures. You know Games Workshop, where all the people with beards
like
and poor personal hygiene work. Yeah. Sorry to anyone who works in Games Workshop. But it's true. And, you know, they had the little lead figures that they paint and stuff. It will not surprise you to hear that I did that as a teenager.
Of course you did. Teenager, my
Anyway, that universe, which I have to say is an incredibly rich universe. I'm obsessed with the universe. It's this grim dark, it's really brutal. It's all space marines and the Imperium of Man, lots of Latin and portentous stuff in it. Anyway, so they are turning that into a series, but they're basing it on a character called Eisenhorn, who's like an Imperial Inquisitor, because it's terribly racist, Warhammer 40,000. But racist against aliens. Like, so they have a real thing against the Xenos, the corrupt Xenos. It's all very thinly veiled. Anyway.
So Eisenhorn is the
lead in a character. He's the lead in a character. He's the lead character in a series of books by Stop yawning. Stop theatrically yawning.
I didn't even. That just came out my
Anyway, throat. He's the lead character in a series of books written by Dan Abnett, which it will not surprise you to hear that I've read. And he's an Inquisitor. And so this series is going to be focused on Eisenhorn, and it's going to be set in the Warhammer 40,000 universe. And I am so here for this. I cannot even tell you. I'm super mega ultra excited.
Anyway, more importantly, Ted Danson and Tina Fey, have you seen this? It was announced today, are teaming up for a new comedy on NBC. Two legends, two giants of TV comedy. She's writing it, he's going to star in it. I think she'll be in it as well. He's going to play a businessman who runs for mayor of LA for the wrong reasons. Once he wins, he has to figure out what he stands for, gain the respect of his stuff, and connect with his daughter while controlling it. It sounds a bit like a kind of Trump comment to me.
There aren't really enough dark Eldar in there for me, boy.
I know, but forget that. But one of my favourite things about this whole thing is Tina Fey's statement, which was, "We're thrilled to be back home at NBC and writing for one of the network's greatest stars of all time, Mary Steenburgen's husband."
Very good.
Good. Very good. Gossip Girl is getting sequeled / rebooted. Did you see this?
Isn't it always?
Yeah, I thought it already had been.
No. So,
Hang on, it already has been.
I thought so, yeah.
James. It already has been.
Maybe we imagined it.
No, it hasn't. Okay.
It has.
What are you talking about?
It has.
Where?
On the television.
Hang on. What? This is not a thing. That is not a thing. Is there? I'm very confused. Well, anyway.
What's this one?
Hang on. So when was this reboot? So Gossip Girl was a thing and it ran and it finished.
Yeah.
When did it come back?
Like recently.
You're making this up.
I don't know. I mean, it feels that way to me, but I don't know if I might.
You're literally making. Do you know what Gossip Girl is? Do you?
It's that Penn Badgley thing about rich kids on the Upper East Side.
Well, it is about that, yes.
And Penn Badgley. What's his name, boy? Do you know? You work at Heat Magazine.
Yeah, Penn Badgley. Yeah.
And Kristen Bell is the titular Gossip Girl.
I think it never actually did come back.
I know! This is what I'm telling you. It was what you're saying, it was just gossip.
Yeah.
Girl. Anyway, sorry our knowledge of Gossip Girl isn't as deep as yours.
It's true, it isn't. So Gossip Girl is coming back, but there was talk. There's been talk of a revival for. It was at the CW, they were talking about this, I think. But this is going to be a spin-off set several years after the original series. So I think it's going to follow a new group of Upper East Side teens with lots and lots of privilege and money.
It sounds fascinating.
All right, fine. It was a very popular show. We don't
see enough stories about really rich people in positions of privilege. Maybe we could have a few more.
All right, fine. Well, should I tell you that the first image of a roach in The Witcher appeared? Roach, of course, being the Witcher's horse.
Oh my God, you really. Right.
What is happening?
No, there's more. There's at least two other things, and one of them Terry Warner discussed.
Terry, my other news story.
And the other one I want to discuss. There's going to be two things. I'm going to discuss mine after Terry. But Terry, I believe you first probably want to talk about 13 Reasons Why.
Oh, yes, I do want to talk about 13 Reasons Why. So there was news this week that Netflix have edited out the very controversial and very graphic suicide scene in season one. Quite why it's happened now. Boy, do you know why now?
No.
Is it three years?
3 years, two, at least
I
two.
My guess is, it is weird, but there's a third season on the way fairly soon, and I think they didn't want people to, because that has remained controversial throughout. Because when season two arrived, there was the people were talking about that still, and saying you're not dealing with these issues in as sensitive a way as you should. You're not paying enough attention to the experts on this, and I think they just wanted to, I don't know, nip it in the bud, but it is weird. Yeah.
It is, and people have reacted. It's interesting. It seems to have split people. So, people on Twitter specifically, which maybe isn't a good gauge of humanity, but a lot of people are saying, oh, don't be so sensitive. There's a warning before it. People can just skip it. My feelings on this are that however this is rated, wherever the people who make this programme think it's positioned, it looks firmly like it is aimed at teenagers. A lot of teenagers I don't know loads of teenagers, but I know a lot of parents with kids who are teenagers. I genuinely felt that the scene was so graphic. It's one of the most detailed, if not the most detailed depiction of suicide I've ever seen on TV or film. It is fundamentally a step-by-step how-to guide of slitting your wrists. And I think there was a level of gross irresponsibility with that. You can put warnings on, you can put that, and it isn't about sensitivity. And people go, oh, people are so sensitive these days. It is not about offending people. It is not about being sensitive. It's about having a sense of responsibility as a program maker to safeguard portions of your audience that will take things away from that they shouldn't. And this isn't about a nanny stay and people not being responsible for their own actions. It is that if you are able to watch something and understand step by step how you could do that to yourself, which is why these restrictions exist, which is why people are so careful with depictions of suicide and self-harm in TV and films for this very, very reason, and to show it in such detail and such practical and granular detail, I have always felt really strongly was hugely irresponsible on behalf of everybody involved. However, why now? Fuck knows. It seems like shutting the what's that saying? Bolting a door. Horses bolting doors everywhere.
Yeah.
Friends, kind of bastardization.
That's right.
But
it's weird, yeah. Horses everywhere.
Horses everywhere.
Horses everywhere. Yeah, it does feel a little bit like a couple of years too late on this. And they doubled down on it. I mean, they defended it at the time and said, no, we absolutely were certain we wanted to show this. So clearly they're less certain now. Mm-hmm. I don't think you needed it. I think that show was absolutely traumatic enough without that, even thematically. I don't think you needed it for emotional weight. I mean, there was enough of that in there. Anyway, weirdly, I found that I was obsessed with that series when it was on and I watched it compulsively. I didn't watch season two because I found its use of sexual assault problematic. And I think, I had more issues with that. And apparently they doubled down on that in season two. And I was like, nope, not for me.
Yeah. But I do think, and I agree with you, like even the rape in season one, I found very difficult to watch. But I do think there is a distinction between something being disturbing and something being irresponsible. And I think that there is a very different thing. And I think something being a matter of taste is one thing, but I don't think this was a matter of taste.
No, this was, I agree. I think this was an element of just being thoroughly irresponsible in what they were showing. And, you know, no one's saying that this led to a spike in suicides. However, there was one shortly after it aired, and that may or may not be related to it. But, you know, even if there's a hint that that might be possible, then you go in and you sort this out because you have responsibility. Anyway, that's 13 Reasons Why. The other thing I want to mention is the fact that the people who brought us Jack Ryan will soon be bringing us Jack Reacher for Lee Child's creation, The Man Mountain, the man with fists the size of supermarket hams and a scything elbow to die for. Jack
unless
Reacher.
Unless he's played by Tom Cruise.
Unless he's played by Tom Cruise. He's coming to the small screen. Could be played by Tom Cruise. I seriously doubt it. But it's going to be a limited series, or it's going to be an ongoing series, but I imagine it will be like Jack Ryan. It will be a sort of a run possibly dealing with one book, I would say, in the first season. There's like 26 books, maybe? There's loads of them. So, I don't know, we'll see. 23 novels, I think, and there's a 24th coming out in September. So, I'm very excited about this. Chris McQuarrie is exec producing this, who, of course, directed the big screen Jack Reacher. I'm down with this.
But he did a really good job with that first film.
He did. The second film I do not like.
No. Well, I enjoyed it, but it wasn't as good. The first one was a proper, really good, really well-made
thriller. I think, and I really like it as well, and I think McQuarrie's excellent. I think Tom Cruise is excellent in it. However, I feel it is not a Jack Reacher film.
Oh, no, completely.
But I don't think that's a bad thing. Like, it's fine.
Do you think they're going to cast a tall person?
I think you have to.
This is what's fascinating me. Yeah. Are they going to go anti kind of what they've done in cinema and go,
yes,
we're going to do a type?
You have to. Yes. You have to. It'd
be fun if they didn't. It'd be fun if they cast someone who's a bit like Tom.
No, like, but actually casting this
really
role.
Fuck over
this
the
is
fans.
John Cruise.
This is a really
he's
difficult role to
five
cast.
Six.
It's a very difficult role to cast because you know, first of all, he's of a certain age, so it can't be like a new unknown. It would have to be a slightly older unknown. And also, if you want him leading it, you want someone slightly recognisable. But you are limited to your Liev Schreibers and your Joe Manganiellos and people like that who are huge, imposing slabs of beef.
Liam Neeson would have been perfect like 10 years ago.
No, he's too thin.
He's always been thin.
Is he thin?
He's been thin even as a young man. He's slender. He's all about the violence,
Jack
but he's
Reacher,
not about the build.
Not Michael Collins. No. You need someone who's like as broad as they are tall. You know, bear in mind this is a guy who stops a 22...
As broad as they are.
Who stops a 22 caliber bullet with his pectoral muscle. You know, so yeah, this can be interesting. I'll see what they do with this, but I'm obviously very, very down for this particular thing. Anyway, that leads us to the Emmys. Boyd?
One more thing before the Emmys.
Okay.
You know, Oliver Jackson Coen is going to be in the sequel to The Haunting of Hill House, The Haunting of Bly Manor.
I did see that.
And this is when I first saw this, I thought, oh, that means there's going to be a connection between the two stories, because obviously this is a completely different story. This one is based on The Turn of the Screw, but he is just playing a different character. So it's not necessarily, there isn't necessarily a link between, but it's still interesting that they're casting him, who was one of the standouts from season one, in season two, and I'm very pleased they are, because I think he's really good, and I'm really excited about the
Looking
show.
Forward to that a lot. So what were your general feelings, Emmywoods, other than the fact that everyone's just decided that Game of Thrones deserves some awards?
I mean, it's Game of Thrones show, but I think it was heartening to see Killing Eve get more, and in and kind of spread around the cast and crew, right? So Jodie Comer was famously overlooked last time, yep. which is an absolute fucking disgrace. She and Sandra Oh got nods these times. Got nods these times. This time. So 9 nominations this year, 2 last year. So I think that kind of shows the impact it's made. And Fleabag, which had 0 nominations for season 1, has 11. Yeah. I mean, that second season has kind of taken off in the States the same way it has here. The impact has been incredible. Yeah.
Andrew Scott, not one of them, though.
No.
Which I am outraged about, personally.
Personally. Yeah. Fight for the priests. Fight for the sexy priest.
Sexy priest, for fuck's sake, yeah.
Should we go through these category by category, avoiding ridiculous categories?
Really?
Welcome
you know there are about
to the
50
world's
categories.
Longest podcast. Yeah.
All right. Or you could go show by show, because Game of Thrones 32, which is the most ever for a single show.
Yeah, and also, interestingly, like I remember I was reading the Gwendolyn Christie thing in this. It wasn't just Gwendolyn Christie. It was also, I believe, I want to say Carice Van Houten and Alfie Allen, who were not nominated by HBO, but essentially went, fuck you, nominated themselves and got shortlisted. Yeah, fair play to them.
I have a feeling they're not going to win that many.
No, I agree. But then look at who they're up against. Like, if you look at the best supporting actress category, you know, you've got Sophie Turner in there, you've got a bunch of people, and it's like, okay, fine, but Fiona fucking Shaw's in your category. Do you know what I mean? Not to take away from their achievement, but it's kind of hard to top that, isn't it? So, yes, I think you're right. I think, I mean, drama series, I reckon they're in with a pretty good shout. I mean, if you look at what else is up there, I mean, you've got Poe, Succession, This Is Us, Killing Eve's in there, Bodyguard, which is an outlier, I would say. Better Call Saul again. I think Thrones in drama. Comedy series, obviously Fleabag's up against up against Russian Doll.
Comedy is
well
an incredibly strong category.
Barry, Mrs. Maisel, The Good Place won't win, but I'd know. That's a really hard one to call. Yeah. Really hard one to call. It's nice to see Chernobyl getting some recognition. It's a limited series alongside Escape from Dannemora. Fosse Verdon, Sharp Objects is in there as well.
Sharp Objects for best limited series and Amy Adams and all that.
I mean, for limited, I couldn't pick a winner out of limited series. Couldn't pick a winner out of limited series. Yeah, Chernobyl, Sharp Objects, When They See Us. I mean,
I think it's Chernobyl or When They See Us, isn't it? So that is absolutely impossible to decide. I think,
it's funny, isn't it? Because Sharp Objects is amazing, but it feels a bit, oh God, wasn't that last year? Do you know what I mean? It feels too long ago.
Yeah.
What else have we got? Bandersnatch got a nomination. That was surprising. Television movie. Lead actor in drama series, Bob Odenkirk. Kit Harington's in there for lead actor.
I know.
Okay. I mean, we love him and everything, but...
Yeah, no. I love him, but that's...
If we're talking about somebody pulling one face...
Stink face!
Oh, my
yes.
God.
You've done it!
And
stink face.
Through 8 years.
Yes, 8 years of stink face.
800 hours of television.
Oh. Yeah. Kristen Ritter, is forgiven.
When you saw that documentary, did you ever see that documentary about the last episode? That is just his face in through that as
it's
well,
perma,
in real life.
Perma stink face. Wow. Okay. So, best lead stink face in the drama series, Kit Harington. That could happen. Lead actress... drama series, Emilia Clarke's in there, but she's alongside Jodie Comer. Do you know what I mean? Viola Davis for How to Get Away with Murder, Laura Linney for Ozark, Mandy Moore's in there for This Is Us, Sandra Oh also in there for Killing Eve, Robin Wright for House of Cards. That's a strong list. Lead actor in a comedy, Anthony Anderson, Don Cheadle for Black Monday. Didn't like the show, did like him. Ted Danson, who is excellent in The Good Place. Michael Douglas for Kominsky Method, also very exciting. Bill Hader for Barry, Eugene Levy for Schitt's Creek, a show that I did watch. I didn't do it for Did we do it for Funny
I
or
was
Dyer?
Going to mention Schitt's Creek. I don't think we have officially done.
No, because I did. I watched the first episode of Schitt's Creek because someone told me I'd love it, and I did not.
I didn't either. But you know, I watched a recent episode recently. It's got much, much better.
Okay,
I think it has.
Maybe we'll.
Kind of
if someone wants to pick an episode of Schitt's Creek for Funny or Dyer, then do tweet it at me, and we'll see if we can give that a go.
Have you mentioned Russian Doll yet? Which I love the fact that that's got 13 nominations.
Indeed, and including lead actress for Natasha Lyonne. So that's. But then she's in the same category as Phoebe Waller-Bridge. So that's. But even then, you'd think like lead actress, and you think in terms of comedy series. As well, they're both very, very strong in that.
Incredible.
So I don't know what that will get.
Do you know who the most Emmy nominated person this year is? The individual.
Go on.
With the most Emmy nominations.
Go on.
James Corden.
Is it?
Yeah.
Really?
Oh, is he in the
he's
live?
Got 6 nominations. Ooh, outstanding host for something called The World's Best, which was a smaller thing he did, like a kind of show, a kind of competition show he did. Carpool Karaoke, the Paul McCartney special of Carpool Karaoke, and the Late Late Show, Best Writer Talk Show, outstanding interactive program, and he helps with the scripts, so he gets he's a credential writer, so he's got six nominations.
Do you know what? I've got a lot. He's very talented.
He's brilliant. Yeah. I think it's incredible considering how much he still gets to some extent slagged off here.
He does.
You know,
he doesn't get that in the States, though.
Not at all.
No, when I lived there when he took over that show.
Yeah.
And nobody really knew who he was, right? Why would they?
Yeah.
And the buzz around him, with no kind of preconceptions over who he was or anything like that, was insane. And I think late night television is one of the toughest slots on American TV. It's notorious for how cutthroat it is, how difficult it is, how many people have fallen on that slot. His success, I think, is absolutely extraordinary. And I think people don't give him enough recognition for that.
Yeah.
To go to a country that isn't your own, to understand the culture enough to be able to every single day help to write a script which connects with an audience that is not the country that you have even lived in for more than 5 years. And to be able to do it at that speed and deliver it the way he does every single night, I think is remarkable. And just coming up with segments like Carpool Karaoke,
which is genius.
Like that in and of itself, I think it's like creatively, he's clearly a huge talent. And everybody in this country is a dickhead.
See also John Oliver for a Brit who's gone over there and absolutely nailed it.
Yeah, but I think what Gordon's doing is hard.
It is hard, and he does it every night.
Everything that
he does, he doesn't just do that. And we're not going to talk about the trailer for Cats. We're going to move on from that. But despite the fact that James Corden does not appreciate my contribution to this particular podcast, and clearly that is still a bugbear of mine.
Maybe he'll start following
you on Twitter one day. He does follow me on Twitter,
actually. Oh, there you go, fine. It is an incredible achievement, yes.
Yes, indeed. So that's pretty good as well. So big up to James Corden and everyone else. I'm excited about the Emmys, actually. The thing that actually detracts from the Emmys for me is they've got, Best Reality Competition Show. And it's like, oh, come on.
Don't be a snob, though.
I will be a snob.
This is TV awards. This isn't cinematic TV awards. No. This is TV awards. And that means TV watched by everybody and not just you, you massive
you
snob.
And there's a massive skill in putting
that
those
shit.
There is.
Yeah, you twat. There's a massive skill in putting together.
No,
yes,
these are people waging a war against the IQ of the human race.
Oh,
and I'm having absolutely none of it.
World.
Reality TV is a plague on all our houses. No. I have never watched an episode of Love Island. Fuck you all.
I don't watch Love Island, but I do. I am not so narcissistic to believe that something I don't personally appreciate doesn't have validity to other people.
This is how much of a twat you are. You're not even... RuPaul's Drag Race is one of those shows. RuPaul's Drag Race is a reality competition program.
No.
But just it's not exploitative, right? Yeah, these shows change the way people think about, people.
These shows are populated by twats, and I have to do the podcast with you two. I don't need to then invite them into my home.
Look, I think I would hope, James, sometimes that, you grow as a human being and you learn to have appreciation for stuff that doesn't fit within your own narrow world for you.
Never.
You know what? We should have a new slot. When Funny or Die, which
quite soon
runs out.
Oh,
reality or Die?
Yes!
You have to watch a reality
show. Watch a reality show.
Real or no real. I don't know.
Yes.
I'm not doing it. You can't make
Keep
me.
It real with James
it.
Dyer. Keep it real with James Dyer. Keep it real with James Dyer.
Okay, let's entertain this for a second. Yeah. What would you start with?
Queer Eye. Yeah. Which is,
you would fucking love Queer Eye.
Would I?
Yes. You would cry.
I've never seen the Drag Race one. I've heard good things about that.
The Drag Race one.
Yeah.
Coming soon.
The only reality TV show I've ever watched, when Big Brother first started, I think I watched an episode, which might have been the last one of series one of Big Brother.
Wow. Christ,
and again, I was just thinking, these people are idiots and they're awful. And why am I watching
them
do mundane things?
It varies. Like anything, it varies. There's
this is snobbery, and it's
genre.
Also classism, and it's elitism.
God.
This is the audience and the participants mainly in that kind of television are working class, and I think that's really
the
problem.
It's the main place you find working class people on TV is in reality TV, because you're not going to find them in drama.
Yeah, but I wouldn't watch the real Downton Abbey either.
Yes, you would. Who are you kidding? Oh my God, that's the most disingenuous thing you've ever said.
I like fictionalised stuff. I wouldn't watch it if it was reality. You gotta be kidding me.
I'm pretty sure there was a real Downton Abbey.
But I don't watch variety TV either.
But
I can't watch anything hosted.
There is judgment in what you're saying.
Yeah.
As you rail against them.
Absolutely.
So this isn't about your personal taste, as in you going, I don't watch Anandak Saturday Night Takeaway. This is a judgment on your part.
It is. I think they're idiotic.
You can think it's idiotic, but you can't think it has no value whatsoever within popular culture.
I mean, can't I?
Oh my God.
I feel, maybe I could ask you, it's weaponized against culture, in inverted commas.
I think occasionally it's weaponized against the working classes, for example.
Benefit
Jeremy
Street and shit
Jeremy
like that.
Kyle, yeah. It's working class people being used against their own communities. Mm. I absolutely think there is a strand of that, but I don't think you can use that to proclaim all reality television is shite.
You've just exposed the lie in my I have never watched reality TV. When I was revising for my finals in the last year of university, I watched Jerry Springer every day. I don't know why. I don't know why, but I became addicted to Jerry Springer at university.
Were you having a breakdown?
It's entirely possible I was having a breakdown, but I got obsessed with Jerry Springer. Maybe that's the reason why. Like, Jerry did it for me. I couldn't deal with it after that.
We haven't got time to deconstruct your psychology.
That's something for a therapist to deal with down the line. Right, okay. Let's move on from, what was it called? Keeping it real with... Anyway.
Keep it real with James Dyer.
Yeah, that will come in a future episode. Let's move on to reviews, looking at some shows that are out this week. First... as we do in the reviews section for That Is What It's Called. Mm. First up in reviews is Amazon's The Boys. This is based on Garth Ennis and Derek Robertson's comic book of the same name. It's a rather anti-heroic look at the world of superheroes, taking place in a world where superpowered people are commonplace and, not to put too fine a point on it, just as likely to be bellends as the rest of us. More likely, in fact. They say power corrupts, so I guess these people are super corrupted? Anyway, it's a lot darker and edgier than I thought this would be. I've never read the comic, and I kind of thought it was going to be, you know, a little bit tongue-in-cheek. But, this caught me off guard. What do you think, Boyd?
Yeah, I thought tonally, interestingly, it was a bit similar to last week's Deadly Class.
A little bit, but much edgier, I thought, than that. Like, the places this place goes.
I'm about to say, even edgier, even more daring and bold. There are some moments in this. There's a bit. So yeah, it's got a very interesting. I think it is a very interesting premise. Perhaps even more interesting, in fact, than Clash, which we really liked. Which is that there's this agency. There's a kind of talent agency for these superheroes. So it's focusing not as much on the superheroes as the people
and their corporate
in this
sponsors.
Agency. Yeah, led by Elizabeth Shue, brilliantly, who I love. And their job is to do the PR and cover for to kind of manage the outrageous private lives of these fucking ludicrous.
It treats them like celebrities.
It's a commenting on that thing which does actually happen constantly in the real world, that celebrities are having their lives covered up by publicists and the press and the media. So it's commenting on that. And the scenes of stuff they do in their private life in this, there's a bit where they go to this place where they have like orgies and stuff. It's an incredible sequence.
With the mini man.
You'll know it when you see it. My jaw genuinely dropped. And so I thought in this day and age of everyone upping the kind of ante in terms of shock value and how daring, how far you go. This did have moments where I was shocked, and right at the beginning, there's a very violent scene involving this couple and what happens, and that was truly shocking.
Really shocking.
And brilliantly done. This is extraordinary, even more again than Deadly Class, the production value.
Yeah. This shows up the limited budget on Deadly Class
badly. It feels like a genuinely ambitious, bold cinematic thing. So you've got the as I say, the PR people covering up for the superheroes, and it's also dealing with things like the Me Too. There's a Me Too element, which is very interesting. So it's using this comic book thing, which I also have never read, to explore very interesting ideas and themes. I really loved it. One issue is it's got Carl Urban doing a terrible kind of Cockney accent, and I don't know why.
Is it because it lapsed between Cockney and Australian? So I wasn't sure. Is that just him being Australian? I was a bit thrown by it.
I don't know. And Simon Pegg doing an American accent as the father. That costume was weird.
Like, I've only seen the first episode. Like, it felt like he felt a bit thrown away in this. Because if you're going to have Simon Pegg, you want to make a meal out of him.
It is weird. And that's not a comedic... I mean, I'm not saying Simon Pegg can do anything, but it's just like a weird bit of casting. He's playing this guy's a dad and he's American. He's a bit gruff.
Also, I don't know what it says about sort of me in terms of aging, but it never occurred to me that it was his dad. I assumed it was just his friend. And then he's like, oh, dad. And I'm like, oh, really?
Yeah.
Dad?
I thought it was pretty incredible.
Yeah, it's very good. Like, I like the same things that you like. Like the hit and run moment really kind of took my breath away. The Me Too moment was horrible, but also entirely believable in the way that kind of plays out. It slightly bothered me, but one of the superheroes is called Black Noir, and I just like the tautology there upset me. But also the Homelander, who's kind of like the Superman character, the head of this sort of gang of superheroes, was an interesting one for me, for reasons I won't say entirely because it's a spoiler, but Also, because it's played by Anthony Starr, who is, of course, Sheriff Lucas Hood in, of course, Banshee.
Oh, my God. How did we get to Banshee?
Got to Banshee.
Everything comes back to Banshee. What did you think, Terry?
I really liked it. So, I'm not going to watch anymore because it's...
Because there's Downton to watch.
Well, do you know what? It's not my cup of tea. However, let me say, as Boyd said, it's remarkably well done. The incident he's talking about within the first 10 minutes is so superbly executed that I had to rewind it a few times trying to work out just the fuck how they'd done it. The whole superhero satire is really interesting. The like comment on culture. There's a scene with Starlight, who's the new kind of recruit to this Seven band of superheroes. She rings her mum and her mum tells her this story about how she saw her friends and her friend was like, oh my God, my daughter got into medical school. And she's like, who cares? My daughter's a superhero. And that whole comment on, as you say, celebrity culture. The Me Too stuff did make me uncomfortable. And I think it's always difficult when you're in this place of kind of shock and awe and satire. And I still don't know how I felt about how it was handled. I agree with what you're saying, James. It was really realistic, but it kind of, was it being used for anything other than kind of a crass depiction of the bad shit that went down?
Yeah.
Is it going to be resolved in any way that's satisfactory? Like when there's a moment where, after whatever happens where she's vomiting in the toilet, and I won't say any more than that, but it's like I found that a really upsetting moment.
But I like the interest that the power isn't always physical, that power is implied and power is structure based, because she is a superhero with, it looked like, significantly higher grade superpowers than the guy abusing her, but he was using his status power to essentially override her superpower to make her do things she didn't want to do. I thought that was an interesting...
But it's a tonal thing, right? Because you are flipping between, there's very flippant moments and very funny moments, and then there's that, and it is, and so it's sat kind of uncomfortably with me, and maybe it should, and maybe that's the point of it. I don't know. It's the only bit that I kind of struggle with. But everything you're both saying is right. It's just so expertly done. The fucking accents are like off the scale. I'm like, somebody shut him up. But the choreography, there's a fight scene, which is incredible. I really respected and admired this, but I'm not going to watch it anymore.
Fair enough. Well, anyway, that is The Boys, and this airs on Amazon Prime Video on Friday, the 26th of July. Next up is I Am, an anthology series from writer-director Dominic Savage. This is a trio of episodes, each entirely standalone and telling female-centric stories from the perspective of three different women, each dealing with a different emotionally potent situation in their lives. The first one, I Am Nicola, which airs this week, stars Vicky McClure. The second, I Am Kirsty, stars Samantha Morton. And the third, I Am Hannah, features Gemma Chan. Now, none of these feature time travel, spaceships, or Jean-Luc Picard. And yet, I thought these were magnificent.
I love that you love this.
I know, and I really didn't want to watch it either.
No, you didn't. I forced you.
I know. Well, the thing was, so with all of these, I said I'd watch the third one. I'd watch I Am Hannah, because I thought I Am Hannah, Gemma Chan plays someone who is navigating the world of app-based dating. And I thought, at the very least, that's something that I can empathise with. And I found it incredibly powerful, really poignant, so real and raw and believable and emotionally potent about this woman dealing with choice and pressure and expectation as a woman sort of moving into the latter part of her 30s and having to decide, you know, with a mother who's saying, when are you going to have kids, when are you going to settle down? And meanwhile, she's going from one terrible Tinder date to the next, and it's soul-crushingly awful for her. And that really, really comes across. And so I thought this was incredible. I was tweeting about this. I'm like, this is amazing. This is the most amazing episode of anything. And then you were like, oh, you got to watch the others. I was like, oh, do I still? So this morning I watched I Am Nicola, and I was blown away by this as well. And this is Vicky McClure with her boyfriend, who she lives with, just dealing with a relationship in its death throes, and the difficulties she's having and the arguments they have, the domestics they have. Genuinely some of the most real, raw, believable moments of television I've ever seen. I think partly because, as you said, he doesn't script it. It's not scripted. He talks to these actors. He tells them what he wants from the scene. He tells them organically where the character's at, what the broad themes are, and they fumble through it in the way that real humans do. And the way humans argue is not, you know, intellect or logic based. It's purely emotional. It's raw. It's stumbling. It's sort of meandering. It's nonsensical at times. And that totally comes across. And I was watching it thinking, oh my God, I have lived this argument at one point. Like, it was brutal, absolutely brutal.
But he does, doesn't he? According to the excellent feature in Pilot TV magazine last month, he does write a script, doesn't he? So he talked a first draft.
Yes, well, so I interviewed him at BAFTA, and what he does is he sketches out the kind of description of the scene, but what he doesn't write is precise dialogue. Right. So he sketches out what the scene is going to be. He writes a treatment for essentially what the story is. And we should say, actually, that he writes them and he directs them, but the stories are co-authored by the women, which means they come up with the concept, essentially. So each one has a story co-credit with Dominic for each of the lead actors. Now, his filmmaking, though, is really interesting. So anybody who saw last year's The Escape with Gemma Arterton will know exactly what I'm talking about, which is he is known for using mainly improvisation. He really trusts his actors to know what they're doing and to kind of go wherever that scene takes them. He works with a really pared-down crew so that you get this natural feeling as possible. In I Am Nicola, there's an argument in the kitchen, and he told me in the interview that it was essentially kind of one camera, one guy and him, and everybody else was out of the room, and they just set it rolling and let it roll for, I think, 20-25 minutes, and it was just that one shot, one continuous shot. And I think the trust he puts in his actors and the way he shoots just leaves this incredibly naturalistic, intimate kind of, at moments, as you say, incredibly awkward and incredibly realistic depiction of whatever it is, whether it is, as you say, navigating wants and needs and desires as a woman at a certain age, or whether it is a relationship that's become toxic. And we should say that Vicky's co-star, Perry Fitzpatrick, is in This Is England 86 and 90. So they've worked together before, and they actually met at drama school in Nottingham years and years ago. So they know each other really well. And you can kind of tell that, right? They have an intimacy and a kind of a familiarity in shorthand with each other. But it is the normality of these stories. It isn't, you know, these, I mean, the Samantha Morton one is more extreme, but it spans the whole spectrum of life. Like, this relationship is toxic in I Am Nicola and arguably coercive at moments.
Yeah.
But it's also within the realms of relationships probably everybody's been in.
So relatable.
Yeah, there's an argument over leggings she's going to wear to the gym. It's all in the detail.
Who's going to make the pasta bake?
Yeah, it's all in those details. Those details of normalcy that I think make this incredibly powerful. And even though it is told from a female perspective, I think what Dominic Savage is really great at is identifying kind of concerns of human beings, right? These are issues for men, for women. The interesting thing is that he's platforming the female perspective, which I think is fantastic. But the reason I think you're responding so strongly to it, for example, is that they are universal concerns and themes, and everybody can see something relatable in it for themselves.
Yeah, I Am Hannah in particular, I just thought, also, it's just stunningly shot.
Hannah, the one with the dating.
So that's the Gemma Chan one. Yeah. And also, she was unbelievably good.
She's incredible.
Like the tragedy in that situation, the way she conveys it.
And those in that one, and also the men she meets are so brilliantly drawn.
I mean, because a lot completely believable. They're not two dimensional. Like, no. You totally believe these are dates that have happened to someone.
And they don't get much screen. You know, they each get quite a small amount of screen time, because of what which is partly what it's all about. And I thought that was so brilliantly done. How The little pen portraits of these fucking doofuses in their own different ways was so clever.
Yeah.
So that is brilliant about that one. I think what I wasn't expecting with the Vicky McClure one, because I knew, having read the piece in Pilot TV and I knew you'd done your thing at BAFTA, I knew it was, in quotes, about coercive control, because often, you know, people explaining what each episode is about. So you go, well, that one's the one about coercive control. But actually, when you said it yourself, you said kind of, arguably, or, you know, perhaps going into the way they argue. And it does, but it is so subtly done. And it's not, it's like, it's not just going, we're going to address this issue. It's more for me like we're going to address this relationship that's gone toxic, and it's just going to explore how it plays out. And it's so unbelievably real because of that. So it's not trying to, it almost doesn't feel like it's trying to make a point, which it does do. It does make the point. And it's incredible detail about that, as you say, with the leggings and stuff. But there are elements of it that I was surprised. So I kind of almost was surprised how she absolutely hits back psychologically against him, quite rightly. And those scenes are incredibly powerful. There's a brilliant, long, angry speech which I just wasn't expecting that, probably because I think probably the stereotype and cliche of what you assume a thing about coercive control is going to be between a man and a woman. There's a scene where they at the party, at the kind of
the barbecue.
Barbecue. Which is painful.
Oh my God.
So well observed. Yeah. Passive aggressive, ending up in aggressive aggressive. It's that authenticity and realism is, and I know we say it a lot, in the end you have to say stuff. If you believe in something, you say, well, it is believable, authentic, but this is a different level, isn't it?
It really is.
And I was interesting that he uses the phrase in this a few times. I love you so much, he says to her repeatedly. And I thought it was so interesting how that phrase, you'd want to hear that phrase, in the right context. In this thing, every time it says it's like a kind of dagger to her heart, because she's like, oh God, you're just manipulating me with these words.
And it's not, he's not like he's a mastermind manipulator. No, it's almost just instinctive for him. He's not a villain in this. It's just that their relationship is fucked.
Yeah.
And arguably he is probably more to blame than she is. But there's push and pull on both sides.
Well, and there's an incredible shot of him kind of towards the tail end of one of the arguments where you just see this single tear running down his face. And it's one of the most affecting shots of the entire thing. And it causes you to have incredible sympathy with him.
Yeah.
And I think that, as Boyd says, to not fall into those tropes and those traps of this coercive relationship means X, Y, and Z in black and white, in very clear details, is commendable, really, because you can imagine within 50-minute television having this insane pressure, where's your middle, beginning, in your end, and you need to tell a story, and what's your end point? And to your point, it kind of, what becomes is what becomes, just like life, right? What happens is what unfolds because of the two people involved. And each of these episodes is like that. And I think Dominic Savage is an extraordinary filmmaker, actually. And I think he's a very bold and brave filmmaker to make television like this with women like this. And I have to say, like, I loved The Escape last year. I thought it was fantastic. I think it was actually criminally kind of under-discussed and under-viewed. But I think he's amazing. And this is, I have to say, unlike most other things you will see on television at the moment. I really do think that. So people should give it a go if they're in even two minds about whether to bother.
There is only one thing that I think should be said about Vicky McClure's boyfriend in the episode, that when he is trying to romance her, she comes home and he puts on James fucking Blunt. So he's clearly a monster.
That was funny.
He's a monster. Yeah. That is, I am. These sort of hour-long films begin airing on Tuesday, the 23rd of July at 10 p.m. on Channel 4. The first one is I Am Nicola, and the other two will follow after that. Not the same night, correct, you know, on the same day each week after that.
Oh, yeah.
Finally this week, we have the 7th and final season of Genji Kohan's Orange is the New Black. Now, this was among the very first of Netflix's tentpole original dramas, so it's kind of Netflix royalty, this show.
It was number 3.
It was, wasn't it? So it was number 3. House of Cards, and it was that Hemlock Grove, was that the second one, Hemlock Grove? And then this was number three. So last season of this ended with, among other things, Piper Chapman, the central character, being granted early release from Litchfield Prison. And this final series charts, among other things, her reintegration into society while the other inmates remain locked up. Now, Terry, were you a fan of this show?
I was. And actually, what I wrote in my notes before this podcast was, it was the show that first made me fall in love with Netflix. It's the thing I bought Netflix for and then binged all in one go.
Yeah.
I think it was the first thing I'd ever actually binged.
More than House of Cards, this was.
Yes, absolutely. And what I was trying to think about what I love most about it. And actually, I think it was the fact that you had what is ostensibly a story of a very privileged white woman, rich white woman, and what happens to her when she goes to prison. Oh, God, you know, how ghastly it is. But actually, what that character going into that prison allowed you to do was to have this platform to tell these stories of these incredible women of every race, of every colour, of every sexuality. And their stories actually became the most interesting part of Orange is the New Black. They have always, it's always been really sharp, really smart, really funny, but it's always been also a really searing comment on the American justice system, on the prison system.
The commercialisation and privatisation of the penal system.
And actually that continued because in the last season, as well as Piper's release, the other big arc was it moved into the addition of ICE detention centres in Lichfield, which is kind of amazing that this show, you know, you've got you've got politicians who aren't really willing to deal with this yet, but you know, Orange is the New Black has gone there. And I kind of love how they keep pushing the boundaries on that. Now, all of that said, the problem for me, and I've only watched the first episode of season 7, is that the weakest thing, arguably, over those 6 seasons has been the character of Piper, because she's the person I care least about. And she is still a person of immense privilege. Even in prison, she's a beautiful, white, blonde, rich woman. That, in some respects, makes her a target, but also means that it's easier for her. Just like her release is arguably easier for her. So the first episode is kind of split between the prison and her trying to navigate life on the outside. She's living with her brother and his girlfriend and their new baby. And it's all, you know, kind of humiliating. And there's clear comparisons between this existence and the existence she's just left. Her and Alex got married at the end of the last season. She's still got another 3 years to serve. I don't really care. And so what you get is you find yourself longing to go back to those women you've grown to love over the last 6 years. Piper's fine. She can, you know, whatever. She can be on the periphery. But I found myself every time I was taken to the outside to her trying to navigate this life in New York, I just didn't care. I don't know how the rest of the season's going to pan out and how they're going to kind of bring together Piper on the outside and the women still struggling on the inside.
You'd hope she wouldn't dominate it.
Yeah, but I don't know, because she is, as you said, she's the central character, though. Yes. So how do you do that when arguably the other women are more compelling, and actually it's far more interesting in terms of what women who are not in a position of privilege face. And that's why I think this ICE storyline is really, really interesting, to be able to kind of dig into that. So all of this is to say that I love Orange is the New Black, but I'm kind of a little bit unsure at the moment after seeing the first episode on season 7.
See, I felt this show had a while ago maybe outstayed its welcome. Like, I watched this all the way through to the end of season 5. I found season 5, which was the riot season, didn't really work for me.
The timeline,
because it felt very bloated and very long. It was a very condensed timeline, and it was all taking place during this riot. And I didn't enjoy it. It felt like a slog, much like the Marvel shows on Netflix. It felt just too long. And so I got into season 6, which by all accounts is actually better. It's good. And I got a couple of maybe 3 episodes in, and I just stopped. I thought, I'm done with this show. This show should have finished by now. I can't really be getting back into it. So there's a part of me that kind of was slightly resentful of being dragged back to prison again for this one, even if they are changing the formula up a little bit. Mm-hmm. But I think they made a smart move to make this the final season. They should have maybe come to that realization a little bit sooner, but it's fine, you know. And I think showing her on the outside and sort of juxtaposing that with what's happening on the inside is interesting. The ICE thing is interesting. Tasty is now dealing with the fact that she's been framed for a murder she didn't commit. I mean, there's a lot going on, and there are fantastic characters in this. I think possibly the best move they ever did was realize early on that Jason Biggs, who, lest we forget, had loads to do in the first season, was absolutely the least interesting part of this. And I think by shelving her personal life early on and refocusing it, because Chapman sort of fades into the background, and for the last few seasons she has been wallpaper. Like, she's in it, but she doesn't really have primacy, I don't think, over the others. Although I think her and Voss's relationship is part of the emotional backbone, isn't it?
Oh, but who cares, really? Like, on off. You were her drug runner, she dobbed you in. Just get over it. You both just need to move on. I don't care.
It's good that they've got married, and there's a nice scene where she says, you know, I'm going to see my wife, and
that irritated me.
Okay. But I know what you mean. I feel like I actually liked the 5th season with the very compressed time.
The riot one.
Because at least that was like an awareness of this season. We have gone on a long time now. Let's do something a bit different. It was very ambitious. It went on too long. I agree with that. But I found it pretty impressive and compelling, and I thought it really, it just gave a whole new kind of lease of life for me. The last season I found disappointing, actually, after that, because we moved to a new prison, apart from the ice stuff, which was great, and it did focus back again on Piper, and I agree so much that it's always, her and Alex have always been the least interesting. Their characters are fairly banal, and the thing, and now they've got to a situation where she's kind of, because it has to crosscut between her back in the prison of outside the world, of course, and it's making that slightly cliche point that she's in a new prison rather than the prison she's actually literally been freed from with her family, horrendous brother and his partner with their little baby and all that. And I just found those scenes with her, like it is quite focused on that now, because once you cross cut, you can't like just do about 5 minutes of that and then 55 minutes in the prison. So half the episode is kind of her dealing with this new world, and that's not that interesting. And not only is it not that interesting, it's like fairly routine and kind of slightly cliche, actually, that stuff I found. And as soon as you go back to the yard where they're just chatting away, chatting shit, you know, brilliantly scripted and all that Genji Cohen, the showrunner, does brilliantly, that is still brilliant. And like that's still as good as anything out there on TV.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't say, I think I'm still going to carry on watching it, because I do think at its best it's really, really great, and it's funny and it's sharp and it's incisive and it's angry and all of that. But I wonder in the end, is it going to be all about, oh, you know, the kind of what's going to happen to Piper and, you know, yeah.
And the mundanity of her reality now is, oh, she has to go and do a urine test because, you know, and she can't afford an Uber and things that I'm
like... Can she get 50 quid from a really rich dad?
Yeah, she's got to go to her dad and cry for him to get money. Yeah. Like, it seems... And then, as you say, you've got Tasty, who basically won't leave her cell because she's staring down a life sentence for something she didn't do. Like, it's... But even without that, you've got Crazy Eyes, who is just, as you say, chatting shit in the yard. And as soon as she comes on screen, you're like, oh my God, please stay, please stay, please don't leave, please don't leave. Yeah. So that is the problem with it, is her, the kind of reality of the scenes with Piper is just so boring that it found it. And you're also not invested in her, really. No. Even after six seasons, you're like, hope she does all right. I'm not really that fussed. I mean, you know, if like any of the other prisoners had been released, you'd be so kind of there with them every step of the way, hoping they don't fuck up, hoping they kind of get an opportunity again. Piper is a rich white woman with a rich daddy. She's always going to be okay. So that jeopardy that is there for every other female character isn't with her.
Not just that, she's also a bit of a blank anyway.
Yeah.
She's a bit of a kind of, you know, a black hole of character. She's not particularly funny, or she's
essentially the narrative voice, because this is based on the true story of Piper Sherman, who that character is based on.
But once you start focusing on her in the outside world, having to deal with her, she's not interesting enough to sustain that. So absolutely, I agree with all the stuff about her being privileged and all that, but actually she's not even... If she was slightly more to her as a character, that wouldn't annoy me so much, but there isn't really.
No. And interestingly, I did enjoy what you just said, James, about she is the narrative voice. But there is literally more narrative voices in this first episode as the people's kind of inner monologue.
Inner monologue bits are great.
Which are great. And there's a bit where you hear everybody's inner monologue in the prison at the same time as their outward voice. Yeah, and this sense of like kind of women in turmoil and dealing with their own shit is so brilliantly executed in that moment. I really, really loved that. I thought that was really kind of ingenious.
Yeah. Well, let's be honest, if you've watched the first six seasons, you might as well watch another one and just see it through to the end. And you'll get the opportunity on Friday, July the 26th, when it lands on Netflix. I think it's safe to say there can be only one pick of the week.
Yes.
So you're waiting for me to say something facetious, aren't you?
Yes.
No, it is I Am Nicola, isn't it? The pick of this week is I Am Nicola.
It is. But The Boys is...
The Boys is absolutely worth watching.
I enjoyed it.
I mean, they're all three of them worth watching. The Boys is a great thing to watch, but I Am Nicola is...
I Am's going to be, hopefully, a BAFTA-winning standard.
I would have thought without a doubt. Without a doubt. Excellent. So, onward to the Banshee section, which...
How is this still happening?
Which shows no sign of dying and never will, as long as I draw breath. This is where we take a show from the annals of history and dredge it up for your entertainment. I'll be honest, I, on the Empire podcast, not this week, last week, was talking about the film Highlander randomly. And started talking about Highlander, the series. And I stopped myself on the Empire podcast. I said, no, I'm not going to do this. I'm going to do a banshee of this on the Pilot podcast. So for all of the Empire listeners who have come over here specifically to hear this, this is my banshee of Highlander, which unfortunately I've kind of thrown together on the fly because I'd maybe forgotten I was going to do it.
Oh my God.
And now I've just remembered. Christ.
Lucky them, so, and lucky us.
Lucky them. So Highlander, the series, was of course a series spun out of the 1986 film starring Christopher Lambert about an immortal Scotsman or Highlander with a sword. There can be only one, except not, because in this case there are two, because turns out that you got a show about immortals, but it's called Highlander because he's from Scotland. So they're like, oh, no, it's great. We're going to do a series, but we'll do it with another immortal. But then what can we call it? Because we can't call it Highlander. But they can, because while Christopher Lambert was Connor MacLeod of the Clan MacLeod, they have discovered Duncan MacLeod of the Clan MacLeod, a clansman of Connor's. And he's played in this by Adrian Paul, who has an excellent line in ponytails in this. And he runs around with a sword, chopping the heads off other immortals each week and inheriting their powers while navigating life as a 400-year-old Scottish man.
What is the point of it?
It's great. No, see, this sounds terrible.
Your description did not sell it.
I completely admit this sounds terrible. So this ran from 1992 to 1998 with six seasons, and it was A, very popular and got great ratings, but B, was pretty critically well regarded as well. Like, it started off as like a bit of a mortal of the week, and then it became much more art based. In season two, they introduced Joe Dawson, who was a watcher, who was essentially a part of a secret society who knew about the immortals and like charted their coming and goings. And then you had evil watchers, and then you had this one guy, Mythos, who was the oldest living immortal but was masquerading as a watcher. It was a whole thing. So but this show, so the pilot episode of this was actually originally intended to be the third Highlander movie. And it was kind of like, it was going to be a TV movie, so it's quite low budget. But because it was low budget, and because Christopher Lambert only agreed to reprise his role as Connor sort of quite late in production, this was instead written as a pilot for a TV show, which then got picked up. Because Lambert didn't want to do television. It was a different era. They were quite snobby about these things then. And he agreed that it should kind of be a TV series. And they'd originally thought, okay, we'll do a TV series and Connor will be the protagonist. But because he didn't want to do that's why they...
Is he still talking about
My bench, I'm not going to go on this long.
Okay, it's possible I've got too into this. But look, people have come from the Empire podcast just to hear this banshee. They are here Terry's just for this.
What people?
This is why they've come.
What
okay,
the listeners can't
right,
see
right.
is that Terry's head is currently on the desk.
She is.
On the laptop.
She's lying she's on the table.
I don't know whether she's just sobbing
or... Praying for an early death. All right, it's possible I've made this more boring than it needs to be. Okay, well, all I would say is this. So Adrian Paul plays Duncan. Guess who else was in the running for that role?
Sean Connery.
Alexei Denisov. Wesley from Angel. Come on, how is that not? And from Buffy. Wesley. No?
I know who Wesley
see,
is.
This doesn't interest you at all.
No.
All right, well, like...
You tried to pull me in with a Buffy reference.
I did.
I saw
I
what
did.
You did there.
Much like this banshee, the show went on a bit too long, even though it kind of peaked in the middle, and it eventually did die.
What time is it?
Sure.
10 o'clock at night.
It's like midnight. Yeah.
It died. But, and here's the thing, so in the last season of this, they introduced a bunch of female immortals to try and get a spin-off series from one of them, and they ended up using Elizabeth Grayson as Amanda, this other immortal, and there was this show called Highlander the Raven, which was a spin-off of this show. That didn't last that long before it got cancelled. There were two TV movies that followed this, Highlander Endgame and Highlander The Source. There's been an animated series. There's been a Mythos web series. There was a really random kind of reunion episode in 2008, which is super low budget and terrible.
I caved your skull in right now. Mic stand.
Boyd is holding a mic stand aloft, threatening to hit James in the face with it unless he stops.
I won't stop. This is now a filibuster. I'm going to keep on talking until one of you dies. It's amazing. It's Highlander The Series. I can't tell you how much you can buy it for at Computer Exchange because I don't think it's available as a box set. However, Terry and Boyd, for your personal viewing pleasure, the entire series is available to stream for free on Amazon Prime Video. So I think we all know what you're doing this weekend.
Trying to forget this ever happened.
Right. Hyperdrive was a two-series comedy on BBC Two in 2006 and 2007, written by Kevin Cecil and Andy Riley, who gave us Year of the Rat recently on Channel 4. And it was very funny. And it starred Nick Frost, Kevin Eldon, and Miranda Hart, and was a science fiction comedy set in 2151, in which the crew of the HMS Camden Lock stumbled through the heroic missions to protect British interests in the galaxy. And it was funny, and it was better than Red Dwarf.
and Boyd wins.
Hang on, hang on, hang on. It was better than Red Dwarf. You can't just drop.
Well, I am.
Outrageous statement like that at the end of it.
I am outrageously saying that.
And what's it called?
Hyperdrive.
Hyperdrive.
Yeah.
Well,
it
I think.
It sounds right up your street. Yeah, what are you right talking about? Street, yeah.
But as far as the winner goes, Terry, there can be only one.
You already declared it.
I mean, I've tried to be more fair these days, but I swear to God, you make it really hard.
Oh, God. And that is, thankfully, it for another episode of the Pilot TV podcast. We hope you enjoyed all of it up to the banshee bit. And if you did, please head over to iTunes and give us a 5-star rating, as well as a comment like Reginald Wisp, who loves the pod, except for, and I quote, "One tiny issue, James mentions Downton Abbey a bit too much," which of course puts paid to our new segment in which Terry provides a live commentary of all 6 seasons and the upcoming movie while in character as the Dowager Countess. So that's something to look forward to. As ever, we're on social media at James C. Dyer, at Terry_White, at Boyd Hilton, and do not miss out on our live show at the London Podcast Festival on Friday the 13th of September, where you can meet all 3 of us in the flesh and watch Terry yell at me in real time. So that'll be fun. We will be back next week with another trove of entertainment riches for you, including a 3-part anthology of pilot-produced dramas, beginning with I Am Terry, in which a lovable yet irascible northerner deals with a deep-seated sense of class betrayal when her unspoken love for posh porn Downton Abbey crashes against her salt-of-the-earth mining town upbringing to hilarious results. Pilot out.